know, meeting Spud, we only spoke on the phone for the last couple of months, I'd say. So I've not, until yesterday, I hadn't actually seen Spud, and I didn't know what he looked like. So I was thinking, oh no, I'm going to get to the airport, and you know, I'm going to be wandering around, who's Spud? But then on Twitter, I saw his picture, so I was okay, so I was fine, so he was all right. But it's been a great, day. It's been a whirlwind, really, because on Friday, 10 o'clock Friday morning, I was involved and started a football tournament. And normally football tournaments, they're a day long and you have little breaks. This one was 24 hours non-stop football. And originally I was only going to play an hour, then have an hour break, I ended up playing 12 hours non-stop. And I haven't played football for 3 years. I retired officially 3 years ago. And I haven't played, I've just about played 90 minutes of football at a very slow pace for charity. And these games were quite intense and quite passionate. And the competitive side of me started to take over a little bit. So I tried a little bit harder. So if I'm walking a bit slow and a bit stiff, you know why. But it's been a bit of a whirlwind couple of days. But, you know, I'm going to share my story, my journey of football, and you know, the ups and downs, more downs than ups, to be honest with you, but also my faith, because that's when my life started. 11 years ago, when I accepted Jesus as my saviour, that's when my life started. That's when my real life started. Before that, I always described my life as running on half power, because I was struggling. I was trying to get to this goal, being the person or the man that I thought I should be, and every time I got to that point, it was never enough. And 11 years ago, that changed dramatically. I've got a little DVD to play. It's highlights. It's about 4 minutes long of my career. It's only 4 minutes because not much happened in my career. So, but we'll have a watch of that. And if you can count how many goals I actually score on this DVD, I'll be very impressed, because it's not that many, and I'll tell you a little secret about them at the end. But we'll watch the DVD, and then I'll get up and share a little bit more. Okay, that's the end of that. Thank you very much. Thank you. We were having a little bit of a laugh and a giggle about the goals. We showed the goals from many angles, because there's only three goals. But we played it back a few times to make it look like I scored a few more, but I didn't really. I only scored a few goals. But those goals that I scored in the Premier League were always on Boxing Day, 2 years apart, one against Crystal Palace and two in one game against West Ham. To score one goal for me is a miracle. To score two in one game, now that is a miracle. But the biggest thing was, because of my faith, all the national papers interviewed me after the game, and you know, they said, "Linville, you always score on Boxing Day." And I went, "Well, because it's Jesus' birthday, you know, I like to score and give him it." And so, you know, the national press had to put in devout Christian and everything like that. So it was nice, because from my early Christian walk, because I saw God do something amazing in my life, there was no way I was ever going to keep quiet about it. And I went through some stuff going, you know, when I spoke about my faith, because in the dressing room it's not easy to be to be different. Whatever you do or whatever you claim to be, it's difficult. But I realised early on that I couldn't keep quiet about it. But I'll share a little bit about that later on. I'll tell you about my life in terms of where I am today, and then where I was born and how football came around. I'm married to Tricia. We got married in 1999, and you know, we've been together. Before that, we met each other when we was 18. I'm now 39 years old. It seems, I don't feel like I'm going to be 40 in September, but I'm going to be 40 in September. Got three children. Nathan, who's 19, he's just finished his first year at uni. I'm not too sure if he likes the academic side or the social side more. It tends to be the social side, because I do see a lot of his Twitter lines about going out and stuff like that. So I think the social side appeals to him a lot more. Got a daughter, Atlanta, who's 16. She's just finishing her GCSEs, so she's year 11. She's actually the footballer in the family. She plays for Chelsea under 17s and just been picked for England to represent England in the Euros at the end of this end of this year. So she's doing really well, really pleased, because she was struggling at school academically, but all of a sudden picked up with her marks and grades, and then football came along, and she's worked just as hard to achieve something that's been a passion and goal for her. And I think beating her big brother has always been a drive for her. So pleased for her. And I've got Cameron, who's 10 years old, and he likes surfing. Now, I haven't worked that out yet. I know we live on the coast and everything like that, but he likes surfing. Football, he doesn't mind, and cricket, he doesn't mind. Surfing is what he really likes. So that's my family. My parents have moved down the south coast as well. They live with us as well down, not too close. You know, they have to ring when they come round, so they don't just pop in, but close enough. And, you know, it's lovely to have them around. But I originally was born in London, East London, Stratford, where the Olympics were last year. And I lived there for 21 years, lived in a high-rise block of flats for 17 of those years, lived on the 17th floor, so could oversee most of London. And, you know, I suppose at the time London was a place that, notorious for all sorts of things. But in East London, there was always a gang mentality. There was always the gangsters that were around. And I think the way that East London and everybody represented themselves, if you done well, you got looked after. If you wasn't doing so well, people would try and help you out. But if you went against anybody, you know, there was always a problem. So everyone is a real community, and I recognised that from an early age. And I always loved sports. Sports was a big thing in my life, but football was my main sport that I sort of pursued. And it started when I watched a football match. It was a cup final between Tottenham Hotspurs and Man City. It was a replay. And it was 2-2, and Tottenham scored a goal. Ricky Villa scored this goal, a little bit like Lionel Messi. Ran past a few players and scored. And at 8 years old, I said, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to be a footballer. And I didn't know there was other mechanics to becoming a professional footballer, like playing for a team. But I just said, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to play football. So I set up my first football pitch in my mum and dad's flat, the bedroom door being one goal and the front room door being the other goal, my little teddy bears being the opposition players. I used to win those matches comfortably. with man of the match, scored lots of goals and stuff like that. But that was my dream to go out and do that. At 12 years old, I signed for my first team. They played on a Sunday, which was a little bit of a problem for my mum and dad, because my mum and dad, church was the first thing we had to do every Sunday. Church was the main part of our lives. For me, church was no part of my life. I didn't want to be in a church, cold building, guy up the front talking, didn't understand what he said. And what topped it off, my brother wasn't at church and all my friends were playing football, so I didn't want to be there. So with the opportunity to play for a team on a Sunday came, and I took it. My dad wasn't too pleased, and he said to me, Lynn, you can't go and play. Well, he didn't say it in this way, he said it in a bit of a stronger way, but he said, you can't go and play for this team, you know, you've got to go to church. And I said, please, Dad, let me play. And he said, okay, you can play one Sunday, then the following Sunday you have to go to church. And then, you know, I said, that's good, that's a start for me. And then after a couple of weeks, he came and watched me play. And that week we got beat 18-0. Now that was a low scoring defeat. You know, we used to get beat by many more goals than that. And he said to me after that game, he said, Linvoy, you can go and play for them every week. It looks like they need your help. So I was like, okay then. But I didn't even know the rules. I didn't know, you know, the throw-ins or anything like that. I didn't know offside rules. Still don't know the offside rule, but I didn't really understand it. But I was playing football, and that's what I really enjoyed. Within 2 years, the manager of our team, he recognised that some of us were quite good footballers. And he sat us down one day and he said to us, guys, I'm going to give you an opportunity to go forward in your lives. He said, I'm going to write to all the clubs in London to try and get some of the scouts to come and watch you. He said, I want to do this because, he said, in my life, I'd had a lot of problems, been to prison. And he said, I don't want any of you to experience that. I want you to get out there and I want you to give life a go. So for us, we didn't hear about the prison bit. You know, it was like, oh, a chance to play for a professional club. And over the course of about 6 weeks, clubs wrote back and said, you know, we'll send scouts out to watch you. But one club wrote back, and that was Charlton Athletic, and they said, you can bring your team over to play us. Now, Charlton were on the south, were based in South London, we were in East London, so we had to go across the River Thames. Now, for many of us, we hadn't left the Stratford area at all, so to go across the River Thames was like a day trip to France. And the rumour was that some of us bought passports. I was one of those guys that brought a passport. We went over on the Woolwich Ferry, and it's honestly, it's about 10-minute crossing. We went over on the Woolwich Ferry. We had to come back through the foot tunnel because we destroyed the Woolwich Ferry. You know, we were quite excited, you know, excitable young men. So, but it was a good experience. We went over and played Charlton. We lost 6-0, but that was like a win. You know, we was high-fiving. Yeah, 6-0, we've just been beat, but it's good. But the manager of Charlton said to our manager, look, your guys are pretty good. He said, I'd like 6 of them to come back and train with us so we can watch them a little bit closely, see what they're like with the guys who are their age and see if they're any better than those guys. So we went across. I was one of the 6, and we started to train with Charlton twice a week. And I realised from the very first training session that there were 35 other players who all wanted to become professionals. Now, in my head, I thought it was just a few, but when I saw 35 other guys wanting to play football and how good they were, you know, I was quite nervous because I thought, I'm okay, but these guys are really good. So I realised, you know what, I'm going to have to work really hard. And I made some decisions at that point that I wasn't going to go out with my friends. I was going to do extra training and everything like that to give myself the best chance, because I thought my ability alone is not going to be enough. Got to 16 years old, training twice a week and eventually getting picked to play on a Sunday for Charlton. Got to 16 years old and I got offered an apprenticeship. So that was great. They only offered 5 apprenticeships. So it was 35 young boys at 16 who were told, not good enough, you're going to have to leave. Now I saw 35 of my, they weren't friends, but they were teammates, devastated, crying, you know, it's like their lives were over. At 16 year old, they thought their lives had finished. And even though that was at Charlton, this was happening all over the country. 92 football league teams are releasing 20 to 30 players every May. 16-year-old boys who were told in their minds, with their friends, with their families, they're going to be the next best thing, and all of a sudden it's over. You know, and they're in their minds, they're designed in their minds that they're going to be the next Beckham, the next Lampard, the next whoever, and then all of a sudden it's finished. You know, and who are they? You start to think to yourself, who am I? I'm a footballer? No, I'm not. Who am I? And there's so many things that they were going through, so many thoughts that they were going through. Fortunately, I wasn't. But I was really sad for these guys. But I thought, I've got to carry on. I've got to be single-minded and focused. When you're an apprentice, nowadays when you're an apprentice, you turn up with your boots, you train, and you go home. So you nearly think you're a professional. When I was an apprentice, you turn up with your boots, then you'd be given a toilet brush to clean the toilets, then you'd be given your pros kit to fold up, collect, wash, clean his boots, and make sure his kit was right, and then was given all these responsibilities around the training ground. Now, every 16-year-old boy who was doing that didn't want to do it, and I was one of those boys. Then one day, the manager of the first team came and sat down with us. He said, guys, the jobs you've been given, you're not doing them very well. And he said, can I just tell you something? He said, I'm watching you. I'm watching everything you do. So he's like, okay, you know, okay, he's watching us. Yeah, so what? And he said, if I've given you a job to do and it involves cleaning the showers or the toilets, if you're doing that job well, he said, I know I can give you responsibility on the pitch, because if I ask you to pick up a man from a corner, because he does this movement, that movement, but I know I can give you the right things to do, the right skills to do, and I know you can do them, that's fine. But he said, if I give you a job to do that means cleaning up the kitchen, and you leave that kitchen in a mess, the chances are I can't give you responsibility to do on the pitch. And he said, that tells me about your character. And that made me think. I thought, oh no, I better do my jobs properly. You know, I better do them properly, because what he said was, if I can give you something to do small and you do it well, that's good. If you don't do it well, I sort of know that going onto the pitch, you won't do your job well. So that got me thinking. So I started to do my jobs well. People were talking about me in a different way, in terms of, this guy, Linvoy, he's all right. You know, he's okay on the pitch. You know, he's not the best, but he's okay. And he does whatever he does it well. So that was a very quick learning thing for me. By 18 years old, I was given a professional contract. There were 12 apprentices, and only two of us got contracts. That first contract I got, I was ripped off by the club. Now, I won't go into the details of how they done it, but the big thing was, from the age of 14 to 18, I thought, I'm going to give the club everything I can. I'm going to give football everything I can. My first contract, I'm ripped off. I'm thinking, oh, why'd they do that? Don't they like me? So that point where they ripped me off, I started to become very selfish. I thought, I've got to look after myself. So I got an agent and other things around me to make sure I was protected. And football, for me, then became a little bit of a business. Even though that's all I wanted to do from the age of 8 years old, I was now a pro and I thought, I'm going to be in the first team, I'm going to play lots of games, and that would be great. I had a year where I didn't really play. Then at 19 years old, I made my debut. It was live on TV against Birmingham City. It was a 0-0 board draw, really, really rubbish game, but I got man of the match. Now, I always remember, on the way to the game, I went on a bus. Now, after the game, I left in a taxi. And when I left in a taxi, I thought, I've made it. You know, because if you got on a taxi at 18, 19 years old, you've done well. That's what I thought. After the game, coming off the pitch, I was given this bottle of champagne, and a microphone gets put in my face, and the guy says, I think it was Martin Tyler, said to me, Linvoy, great, you've been, you know, man of the match. How do you feel? And I looked at the camera and I went, I feel all right, yeah, really pleased. I was just happy for my chance. And he said, okay, Linvoy, so, you know, Charlton have got financial problems, and what do you think? And I said, well, yeah, the club have got no money, and all us young players are going to get a chance. And he went, okay, Linvoy, so what else do you think? And I went, I was just happy for my chance. He went, here you go, Linvoy, here you go, man of the match, bye-bye, you know, see you later. It was the worst interview ever. And that was my first taste of the media. But overnight, I went from a few people knowing me to the whole of the football world knowing me overnight. And I had friends come out of the woodwork that I never even knew, didn't even know their names. People were coming up to me and said, Linvoy, well done, man. You're so good. Brilliant. We watch you on telly. Superb. You couldn't get us a ticket for the next game. And I went, oh, yeah. And as they walked off, I was like, who's that? Who just asked me for a ticket? You know, and this was happening time and time again. And in the space of making my debut and playing five games, a lot more people knew me. But by the sixth game, I got dropped from the team. A year later, I got told by Charlton, Linvoy, you're not good enough, you can leave. So I was now in a position of, my friends who were released at 18 and friends were released at 16, but I was 20 years old. I was now a young dad. Nathan was just born, 6 months old. And I knew I had responsibilities, but the thing was, for me, I felt like a failure. I felt that I'd let my family down, let myself down. I was hurt. I was angry, disappointed. All the emotions, all the negative emotions that were there, were on me. And I remember driving out the training ground, at Charlton training ground, and I had a little Golf, and I was trying to put it into gear. The clutch had gone on it, and put it into gear, and I just burst into tears, and I thought, it's over. It's over. My dream is over. And at that point, I had a couple of minutes where I thought, right, what am I going to do? Am I going to stay in football, or get a job. And I thought, if I stay in football, the hours are 10 till 2. If I get a job, it's 9 till 5. You know what? I like the hours 10 till 2, so I'm going to stay in football. So I decided to keep myself fit. There was a six-week window before teams tried to sign players. And bear in mind, I was one of 600 players who had been told by their clubs that they didn't want them anymore. So it wasn't as if I was one of a few, 600, and I was just a name in all of that. So it was not many clubs signed players at that time. So I had a big decision to do and make to keep fit, not knowing whether I'd even get picked by a club. Anyway, I got a phone call from Ray Clements, and he was the manager of Barnet, and Barnet were two leagues below Charlton. Obviously, Ray being ex-England international, Tottenham, Liverpool legend. When he rang me, I didn't believe it was him. I thought it was one of my friends messing about. So he rang. He said, "Hi, Linvoy, it's Ray Clements." And I put the phone to my chest. And I said to Trish, "It's Ray Clements." "No, it's not. It's Chris. It's Chris messing about." I went, "Hi." I put the phone back. "Hi, Ray. How you doing?" He went, "Linvoy, it's Ray." And I went, "He's messing about. It's Chris again." "Hi, Ray." And he went, "Linvoy, it's Ray Clements." I thought, it is Ray. So, got a bit serious. And Ray said, "Linvoy would like you to come and sign for Barnet." So I said, "Ray, I'd love to come and sign for Barnet, but I've promised Cardiff City that I'm going to go there and have a trial." And he said, "Linvoy, we'd love you to come and sign for us." I said, "I can't. I've made a promise. I can't do it." So he said, "Let me speak to the chairman and I'll get back to you." So 5 minutes later, he rings me back. He said, "Linvoy, we've got a 3-year contract on the table for you. For you to sign. Do you want to come and sign it?" I said, "Ray, I'll be there in 5 minutes." And I put the phone down. And then I opened up the map and thought, "Where's Barnet?" "Oh, Barnet, that's all right. It was in North London, not outside of the M25. So I was quite happy with that. But I had 3 years at Barnet. And the first 2.5 years of my time there, I was playing regular football. I was learning to be a footballer, learning to win games, lose games in front of fans, learning to deal with pressure of what fighting relegation was or pushing for promotion. And in all of that, I wasn't handling it that well. And I wasn't handling it that well because if I made one mistake, no matter how well I played, if I made one mistake, I thought, "Oh no, that's it, I'm out." And I played under that all the time. I was always angry. I remember I had one game, my early game for Barnet, one of the strikers, very good striker, spoke to me before the game, was really nice, and I thought, "Oh, he's a nice man, all that stuff about him, he's not that bad." The first ball that came over, and it was a challenge between me and him, he elbowed me, I fell on the floor, I looked up and I thought, "Where am I?" And I went to walk forwards and I walked sideways, I was all over the place, and from that game I said, "That's never going to happen again." And I became the aggressor. I became the person that nobody was ever going to hurt me. If someone did hurt me, I'd get up straight away and think, "No, it's not hurt me," even though I'd be in so much pain. But I just went through it. But this wasn't the person I was on the inside. But I was starting to build a reputation of being some hard man on the pitch. So when problems were coming into my life, I couldn't tell anybody because I was this hard person. That's what everyone thought. So I was living a lie, really. I was living a lie on a pitch. But the driving thing for me was anger because I wanted to prove Charlton wrong. That was the only thing that was going to satisfy me in at any point. So after 3 years at Barnet, being runner-up player of the year, 2 years on the trot, then getting player of the year, I then got a transfer to Reading. Reading were in the same division as Charlton. Financially, my life had changed overnight. We moved out to Reading. We owned a house, a detached house, had two cars on the drive. Atlanta was now born. And from the outside, it's great. It is great. But on the inside, it wasn't as good as it looked. And then I realised that Reading were in the same division as Charlton. We were going to play Charlton in October. I signed for Reading in July. Going to play Charlton in October. So all my focus was on that game coming up. The manager of Charlton was the same manager that said I wasn't good enough, and that was Alan Kirbishley. Lots of my old teammates at Charlton were now in the first team, so lots of those guys were still my friends. So when this game came around, Elm Park, where Charlton, where Reading used to play, held about 28,000 fans. I must have bought 20,000 tickets because I wanted everybody on my side. But I woke up that morning of that match. I woke up and I said, today's going to be a good day. You know, it's like a film scene. It's like, today's going to be a good day. And I walked out, got to Elm Park, walked through, you know, walked with my chest out. Today's going to be good. We played the game. We beat Charlton. Was I happy? Happy is an understatement. I was. It was like fireworks were popping out of me. It's like, whoa, this is... Then I realised they're my old teammates. So I went and shook every single old player's hand, you know. And they all said, Linvoy, brilliant. We're so happy for you. You know, your career's gone on really well. And then I saw Alan Kirbishley sneaking off down the touchline. I was like that. And I ran over to him, got his hand, shook his hand, and he's looking me in the eyes, and he wanted to let go of my hand, but I kept hold of his hand, kept it a little bit longer. And you know what he said to me? He said, Linvoy, well done. I was like, oh. He said, Linvoy, I'm so pleased for what you've done with your career. And I was like, oh, I wanted him to be angry because I wanted a little bit of confrontation. I wanted to say, I told you so. And he went, Lin, we're just so glad you kicked on. He said, we felt you could do this, but we didn't feel you could do it at Charlton. I was like, oh, great. And it's literally, I went, oh, and I let go of his hand. He was like, oh, good. Oh, thanks, Alan. You know, and he went down the tunnel. He slammed the door shut, and I thought, oh, at least he's angry. You know, I've given him the ump because he slammed the door shut. But for me, that was it. Everything that I'd put all my focus on for 3 years, put my focus on playing Charlton, beating Charlton, and having the last laugh, it was over. So I drove home that evening. A couple of friends came with me. They left. It's about 10:30, 11 o'clock. I'm sat on the sofa. I'm thinking, what now? What now? What can I focus on? I'm a professional footballer. I'm supposed to be living the life of a professional footballer. And things are meant to be good because that's what I set out to do. Had everything. I thought, you know what's going to make me happy? If I chase money. Money, you know what? The world says money makes you happy. I'm going to chase money. So I chased money for about 18 months. Didn't really make me happy, you know, in all honesty. It just allowed us to buy things when we wanted and, you know, get into debt and all those sorts of things. But then the turning point, is a big turning point, was Trish became ill. She started to suffer with depression. Now, this depression that hit her came about because of loneliness, because we had everything. We had everything, but we didn't have our real friends. Our real friends were still in London, and the estate we'd moved into or onto was, we were very young on that estate, so we didn't really have a lot in common. And people who didn't know us from before wanted to be our friends because of football. They wanted to know Linvoy and his wife. They didn't even know Trish's name. They used to invite us round and say, Linvoy, come round. And Trish used to come, and Trish always described herself as the wallflower, because all of a sudden I get pulled into a conversation and Trish would just be stood there, you know, half an hour later. And I'd be trying to include Trish, and, you know, the conversation would go back onto football, and it became very hard. And one particular, we thought they were our friends, invited us round, and we went round, and all of a sudden these guys turn up in Reading shirts and they started to go for the team. The team weren't having a good time. They started to go for the team. They started to, you know, talk about the players and then really, really tear into every single player. And I said, the only player they didn't have a go at was me. And I think that's because I was sitting there with them. But I said, when I went to the toilet, I think they started on me then. But we left. We left that party. And I said to Trish, never again. Never again. We're not letting anybody into our lives. And at that point, that's when, you know, things started to change for us. Trish became lonely. Depression set in. And I always remember coming home from training, putting the key in the door and thinking, what am I going to walk into? She's going to be happy. She's going to be sad. She's going to cry. I didn't know. I really didn't know. And it really hurt me because this is the woman that I loved. And I was thinking, what do we do? What can we do? The doctors couldn't give us the answers, and you know, no one could give us the answers. And then I sort of went into a contract dispute with Reading and decided that I was going to leave Reading. And by leaving Reading, we sort of thought we can pack up all our troubles in a bag and leave them, you know, sneak off and leave them behind. And by doing that, I sort of left myself open to anything. I was prepared to go anywhere and play, but I was also prepared to give up, because by this time, I've been ripped off by 3 clubs. I've been ripped off by agents. I've been given bad advice about contracts. And I was just thinking, you know what? I don't know if I want this. You know, this football game looks pretty. It looks exciting. It is for 90 minutes. But when that finishes, it's not great. And I thought, no, I'm done. And I was at that point, 28 years old. I didn't have any other career behind me, so I didn't know what else to do. Then I got a phone call from Tony Pulis, who was the Portsmouth manager, and he said, Linvoy, I'd like you to come along for a trial. You know, I've heard you've been released by Reading. Why don't you come along? So I said, OK, I'll come along. I put the phone down. I thought, how dare he ask me for a trial? You know, I'd played against Tony's teams many, many times. He knew what I could do, but I was in that place where, you know what, how can I just go for a trial? Doesn't he, you know, I've played over 300 games, and, you know, he knows I can play, so why only a trial? But thought, no, I'm going to go. I'll just go anyway. Went along, had this trial. It was 2 weeks. Signed a contract with Portsmouth. And things were okay for a while. We moved to Portsmouth. Things were okay. Then Trisha's depression came back. And at that point, I'm starting to question, what's life about? You know, what is life about? Is there must be more to life than this rat race. That's what I kept on thinking. It must be more. And in that time of Trish struggling and me playing, the first year at Portsmouth was just mediocre. We were fighting against relegation. At most clubs I'd played for, I'd fight against relegation. I used to think it was me. And then one day I came home from training and Trish said, Lynn, you know what, I think what would help me get through this is getting a horse. I thought, a horse? You know, but I was in a place where I thought, you know what, she does need help. We didn't even own a cat or a dog, never even owned one, and she wanted a horse. I'm thinking, how's this going to work? And I looked at our garden was tiny, half, not even half the size of this day. I'm thinking, how's a horse going to fit in there? And she said, no, we'll keep the horse at a stables. Oh, okay then. So she pulled out a couple of magazines and, you know, saw a horse, and this horse was, I'm thinking race horses. I'm thinking hundreds of thousands of pounds. Well, there's no way, we can't even afford like £500, but she found a horse and it was £1,000, and somewhere along the line we'd lent some friends some money, an auntie some money, and she gave us this money back without us even asking. We'd told her to keep it, but she gave us this money back, and at the time I thought, oh well, you know what, we weren't expecting it, let's buy the horse. Anyway, we bought this horse, and I just say to you, it wasn't really a horse, it was a wonky donkey, because it had every illness, everything that could go wrong. You know, I knew every term. The phone would ring at 10 o'clock at night, and I knew, I'd say, right, colic, yes. Okay, something wrong with its, yes. And there was so many, there was a list. I had a checklist, you know. And when something new came up, it was like, bingo, yeah, something new. Another fee for the vet. So this horse weren't great. But you know what? This horse helped Trish, because she could become, or she was Trisha in there. You know, she had her time, she had her own time, and she could just enjoy herself. Then the guys that owned the stables found out that Trish was married to a footballer. They started to take advantage of her, which broke Trish. It crushed her. And when I saw her in that place, I thought, this isn't good. So we decided to move the horse to a new stables, which was fine. The stables were a little bit cleaner, a little bit more expensive. And I'm thinking, God, this horse, you know, this, I don't know if this is good. Anyway, moved the horse to this new stables. Trish was there for about a month. And then she came home and she said, Lynn, these guys are nice at the stables. I said, oh, that's good, that's good. Because you've got to remember, nobody got in our circle anymore. Nobody. She said, these guys are nice. And she said, they're Christians. And I went, Christians? And she said, yeah, they're nice people. I said, I know, they always start off like that, you know, be careful. And she said, no, they're really nice people. And for me, the thought process of church just came flashing back. I didn't want to be in a church. And I said, Trish, whatever you do, if they invite you to church, say no. Just say no. She said, why? Just say no. So she said, okay then. Anyway, what happens? A month later, oh, they've invited us to church. I was like, no church. So I said, okay. Now, Trish didn't believe in God. The words she used to use about God and Bibles and everything like that, you know, I can't say here. They were bad, real bad. But when she said she wanted to go to church, I knew she was desperate, knew it. I thought, okay, right, what are we going to do? We can't go for 1 week. It's not going to be a quick fix. We'll go for 6 weeks. I don't know where that number came from. It was like, oh, 6 weeks. Okay, we'll give them 6 weeks. And I'm thinking, right, and I said to the kids, whatever happens, when we go to this church, be quiet. Don't get no attention. Don't draw no attention to yourselves. I'm going to be quiet in the back. This is for mummy. You know, we're not going to get involved. We go along, we pull up, and we pull into this drive, and I'm thinking, whoa, this can't be church. I'm thinking, they've moved the church from where they normally have it to this modern building. Then we walk, get out the car, we're walking along, and someone says, morning. And I'm like, oh, no one says morning. And then there's a few more people, and they're happy. I'm thinking, Sunday morning, and people are happy, there's something wrong. We walk into a foyer, and there's people meeting and greeting, and I'll just keep my head down and, you know, shake hands and, you know, no one's going to speak to me. No one's going to speak to me. And then someone speaks to me and I think, okay, right, just cut the conversation. And there's a little bit of a conversation. I'm thinking, no, they're too nosy. No, get away from me. We walk into the hall. The hall's very similar to this. Just got individual chairs set out and there's a band up the front. I'm thinking, this isn't right. There's no way should a band be in this church. Anyway, they start playing music. I'm thinking, this music sounds all right. But we're in the back. We're in the back. No one can see us. I'm making sure no one can see us. But the music's playing. I'm thinking, this is all right. My foot starts going. I'm thinking, oh, this is good. And then someone looks around, my head's down. Yeah, not really enjoying it. No. As soon as they look away, oh, this is all right. So we get to the end of the service. But before the end of the service, a guy gets up to speak. Shorts, T-shirt. Starts talking, and I'm thinking, ooh, this is different. I'm expecting a collar. I'm expecting him to just open a Bible and just read some stuff, and that's it. But he starts to talk about his life. He starts to talk about Jesus as if he's real. I'm thinking, this guy, he's talking about this man in a book as if he's real. It can't be right. But he got me interested. Anyway, I go back to we go home in the car. Say to Trish, what did you think? She said, I thought it was really good. I said, yeah, I thought it was okay. You know, I played it down a bit because I really enjoyed it. I thought it was okay. Then in the meantime, I meet a player at the club. He becomes my roommate. Coincidentally, he's a Christian. God's got a funny way of doing that. He then pulls out a Bible during the night. And I'm thinking, oh no, they're surrounding me. Anyway, I start to ask him a few questions about some of the stuff I hear in church. And he comes back with some answers. I'm thinking, right, okay. I'm thinking, I'm going to ask him a question and I'm going to ask the guys at church a question because there's no way they can have the same answers. So I ask the question and I say, Darren, you know, what's this, what's that? And he tells me the answer. I think, right, I've got that logged. I'm thinking, there's no way. So I go to church on a Sunday. I say, hey, what about this then? I ask them the question. They come back with the same answer. And for a split second, I think, you know what they've done? They phoned each other up and they said, Linvoy's going to ask you this question. This is the answer you've got to give him. That's what I'm thinking. And then after a little while, I think, no, that can't be right. No, there must be more to it. Anyway, 6 weeks come round. The guys that invited Trish to church, they're now in our house. And it's like, what is going on? But I like them, you know, and I thought they're okay. And this is a big thing for them to come into our circle. That's big, really, really big. So they come around, they start talking, conversation gets onto church about Christianity. And I said, okay. I said, I need to know more. And I grill them, you know, grill a Christian time. It was like, right, I need the answers now. And there's a few things that happened in my life with friends who passed away very young. And I'm like, well, what's that about? What's God say about that? They opened the Bible, gave me answers. And there was nothing I could catch them out on. I really wanted to trip them up. I wanted to catch them out because it was too good. And then I realized, you know what? I'm asking all these things, but actually, we went to church for Trish, but actually I'm asking the questions like it's for me. So in the end, I say, I realize that I need this Jesus you're talking about. And I said, right, what do you have to do? What do you have to do to have this relationship? And the guy who I asked the question to, he must have thought, oh no, he's asked a question, because he wasn't expecting that. And he said, Lynn, there's a scripture here about, you know, accepting Jesus as your saviour, believing what he'd done on the cross for you, but what he'd done 3 days later. I thought, okay. I said, how much is it? And he said, it's free, Lynn, it's free. And I said, nothing in this world's free, man. Nothing in this world's free. He said, Lynn, it's free. You just got to say a prayer. I thought, it can't be that easy. And I thought, okay, it might be that easy. And I said, right. Trish was sat on the sofa next to me and said, Trish, come on, let's go in together. You know, might as well, come on. And she said, Lynn, I've already said it. And I, literally my head almost fell off my neck. And I was like, what do you mean you've said it? She said, I said it a week ago. I said, really? I said, what happened? Because, you know, I'm thinking this is going to be like a big Hollywood movie thing. She said, well, I said the prayer. And I read this book that was given to me. She'd been away for a week. To Bognor Regis Butlins, been away with the kids and her aunt. She'd been given a couple of books, and there was a Why Jesus booklet, very thin booklet that explains about everything that's happened with God, the relationship broken with Adam and Eve and everything like that. And at the end, there's a prayer you can say to accept Jesus as your saviour. And I said, and what happened? She said, I said the prayer. I said, how do you feel? She said, the depression's gone. I said, what, gone? And for 5 years, 5-6 years, tablets, psychologists, whatever, you know, we had all that going on. And she said, after this, saying this prayer, gone. I thought, oh, I said, okay, then if it's good enough for you, I'm in, I'm saying it. So I close my eyes. My mate jumps up, starts praying with me. I close my eyes and hands closed. At the end of the prayer, I say, amen. You know, open my eyes. And I'm expecting the roof of my house to lift off and God's hand to point in and say, Linvoy, you're the man. It's all quiet. And then my mate who reads the prayer with me, he jumps on me. Yeah, Linvoy, you've done the best thing. It's the best decision you've made. I'm like, Keith, get off. I'm not quite ready for that. And he said, Linvoy, the angels in heaven are celebrating. And literally my eyes went, are you sure? And to be fair, he opened the Bible and showed me the scripture, so it was all right. And he said, Linvoy, you need to tell a few people. I thought, oh no. I think, who can I tell? And I thought, right, I know there's one Christian player, so that would be all right. He said, you need to tell a couple of others. Thinking, I can't tell the lads in the dressing room. No way, no way. So anyway, I phoned my mum and dad and tell them. They weren't that happy. They said, Linvoy, have you joined a cult? I said, no, mum, it's about, you know, so I told them anyway. And I had about another 6 weeks, 6 to 8 weeks, not believing I was a Christian, but just not really getting it. But I was reading the Bible, still not really getting it, but I was starting to read things and understand what Jesus had done, and it was starting to make a bit of sense here. And I said, no, I need something real. The words in the Bible, great, but I need something real. And at that point, I had a knee injury, and this knee injury needed an operation. And while these guys who had come around to our house and got and now part of our lives were telling me some stuff, I said, look, I need some hardcore evidence. I need something real. I need God to show himself to me in such a way that I can't deny it. So I said, tell me some stuff that's happened to you. Tell me some things you've seen. And then they started to talk about healings. So I thought, oh, that's interesting. So they told me a couple of stories. And I said, right, at the end of that, I said, I'll believe I'm a Christian if I'm healed and I meet God. I'll believe. So straight away, they all jump up, you know, two of them jump up, start praying for my knee, and, you know, nothing's happening. My knee's moving a little bit, you know, with their hands on it. They take their hands away and, you know, oh, that hurt. I was like, yeah, God really heals, doesn't he, you know, sort of thing. So, I mean, oh, thanks anyway, you know. Right, see you later. A week later, I started to meet with the chaplain of the football club and Darren, who was my teammate. We started to meet and have Bible study with the chaplain of the football club at his house. And halfway through the Bible study, he said, "Linvoy, we really want to pray for you. We want to pray for your knee." I thought, okay then. And I thought, oh, I'll just humour him. You know, I'm not going to deny it. Just humour him. He sat me in a chair, lifted my leg up and started to pray. Within 10 seconds, I could feel this electric running through my knee. I'm thinking, what is that? But my eyes are closed, and I thought, I'm going to open my eyes because he must have one of these electric buzzer things on his hands. He must have. And, you know, but I didn't want to embarrass him, so I kept my eyes, like, a little bit closed. So he couldn't see if my eyes were open, but I could definitely see what was going on. And as he moved his hands, nothing on his hands. And I'm thinking, what is this? And when he moved, there's still this feeling going through my knee. So he said, "Lynn, stand up." So I stood up. He said, "Do something you couldn't do before." So I knew how to make my knee hurt. I knew. So I bent it. Didn't hurt. Didn't hurt at all. And then the next thing you know, they started to pray for me again. And all I can tell you, in that moment of prayer, which lasted, it felt like forever, but it's probably about 10 minutes, I met Jesus. I met him. I didn't physically see him, but all I can describe was perfect peace. Now, I chased peace everywhere, you know, and if the children weren't here and it wasn't in the church, I tell you where I've chased peace. I've chased peace everywhere, but I found perfect peace. And in that moment, I said, "God," I said, "Jesus, whatever you want me to do, I'll do, because I know you're real." And in that moment I said that, I got taken back a week to when I said to those guys, "If my knee is healed and I meet Jesus, I believe I'm a Christian." Now, these guys didn't know each other, but God used somebody totally independent of the conversation I had. They didn't even know I had this conversation and done it. And that was it. I was on a journey. So then I thought I'd start to tell the players, because I thought, yeah, I can tell the players I've been healed and they'll love it. You know, they'll be all over it. They called me weirdo. Well, probably didn't help because I announced it in the local paper that God had healed my knee. So that probably didn't help. But they called me weirdo. They called me God Squad, Bible Basher. And it hurt me. It hurt me. And I didn't know how to handle it. And then all of a sudden, I wanted to know how the Bible was real. I wanted to know how it was relevant for today. That was the big thing for me. It's like, well, how does the Bible work in a dressing room? How does the Bible work when I need to pay a bill? There's no money in the bank. Someone's sick. How does the Bible work? And Darren said to me, "Linvoy, this Bible is living. Everything written in this Bible can apply to your life today." And I said, "Yeah, really, Darren? Can it?" The starting of this was when the lads used to really give me stick in the dressing room, and it wasn't one or two, it'd be five, six, seven of them. When they started to give me stick, it hurt me. And then I used to phone up the chaplain and say, "Look, the guys are giving me stick again, what can I do?" And he said, "Lynn, I've got a scripture for you. It says, if you're persecuted in the name of Jesus, you're actually being blessed." I thought, "Am I?" He said, "Yeah, you're being blessed." I was like, "All right then." So I'd walk into the training ground, you know, and they'd start, "Oh, here comes God Squad, you know, sandals and socks, hey, God Squad, Bible." And as I said, I was like, in my head, I was like, "I'm being blessed. I'm being blessed. Yeah, I'm being blessed. But what am I being blessed with?" I was thinking, I don't even know what I'm being blessed with. But those words started to not bother me. What they were saying didn't bother me anymore because I thought, I'm being blessed. Then I was given a letter by a young, a 15-year-old boy. He was the son of a pastor. And he said, "I just feel God give me this scripture to give to you. And it's Jeremiah 29:11. For I know the plans for you, says the Lord, a plan to prosper you, not to harm you, to give you hope and a future." And when I read that, for the first time in my life, I thought, I don't have to worry about anything. I used to worry every single day of my life. I used to worry about something. If I weren't worried, I'd find things to worry about. And I thought, right, God's got a plan for my life. I don't have to worry. And it was literally like that. So I took that on. Two scriptures changed my life overnight. So going back to football, Harry Redknapp becomes the Pompey manager, and everyone loves Harry. Everyone loves him. Please don't call him a wheeler dealer. He won't like that, but he is a wheeler dealer. Everyone loves Harry. The first thing Harry says to me, bless him, and I love Harry, Linvoy, we don't want you at the club anymore. Like, what? I didn't act like that in front of him. Oh, really? He went, Linvoy, we don't want you anymore. You can leave the club. Now, all the emotions from when I was 20 years old came flooding back. So even though I thought I'd dealt with them, I thought I pushed them away and it was all dealt with, all came flooding back. 29 years old, Harry Redknapp gives me the same news as when I was 20 years old, and I feel exactly the same. I went home, told Trish what had happened, and for Trish it was tough because she'd just settled in, making friends. And I phoned up the chaplain and I said, Mick, what do I do? He said, Lynn, don't worry about it. God's got a plan for your life and I really believe it's in Portsmouth. He said, I'll tell you what you do. You're going to go in, you're going to train every day, but you're not going to go in and worry about Harry. You're going to train and play for God. And he gave me another scripture. Whatever you do in word or deed, do it for the Lord. So I was like, okay, yeah, I've got that, Mickey, got that. So I drive into training and think, I hate Harry. He's not going to play me. He's going to sell me. Turn up at the training ground. What do? I've got to change my attitude. Get out of the car. First person I see is Harry. I was like, oh, no. I've got to be nice to him. Morning, gaffer. Morning, Lynn. How you doing? I was like, oh, yeah, good. Thanks. Yeah, great. You know, get on the training pitch. First one on the training pitch, last one off. And my attitude was, this is for God. This isn't for Harry. This is for God. 2 weeks later, Harry pulls me, said, Linvoy, don't want to sell you. I want you to stay at the club. I'm like, oh, wow, great. But inside, I'm like, yeah, this is for God, Harry, not you. But in that moment of making a decision to do it for God and not for anybody else, that's when my peace came. That season, he put me in the team after a week. One of the players got injured and one of the lads said to me, Lynn, did you pray for that player to be injured? I was like, no, I didn't pray for him to get injured. Don't do that. But within a week, I'm in the team. By the end of that season, we get promoted to the Premier League. I get voted Fans Player of the Year. I get voted PFA Player of the Year by the fans from other clubs. Out of 9 Player of the Month awards that are given out, I win 7. Now, at no point during that time did I ever say, it's because of me. Every interview I'd done, I said, it's because of Jesus. And in the end, the journalists used to wait around. Because we were going into the Premier League, lots more journalists were coming around. And they used to say, who's man of the match? You know, who's man of the match? And they say, it's Linvoy. At first, it was quite good fun for him. It's like, oh, Linvoy, you're proving Harry wrong. Great. And after about, 8 weeks, 2 months, 3 months, 4 months, and I come around the corner again, they're like, oh, no, it's Linvoy. You know what he's going to do? He's going to talk about Jesus. So they say, Linvoy, how did the game go? And I say, guys, I just got to say it's Jesus. And they're like, yeah, we know that bit, Linvoy. Now, what do you think about the game? I was like, no, guys, it's Jesus in me. You know, it's Jesus in me. And in the end, they were like, oh, okay, like, can't you just send somebody else? You know, just send someone else. We don't want to hear about this Jesus guy all the time. But that, for them, was something that I couldn't take any credit for. It was about Jesus. Had 7 years in the Premier League. Had a great time, played alongside some great players, played at some amazing stadiums, played against some amazing players, got embarrassed a few times on the pitch. But you know what? I played with no fear, played with total peace. Because that, I know, that's where God wanted me. And through that, started a charity in 2002 called Faith and Football, using football for the church to engage with the community. And from that, people saw that, Christianity isn't a scary thing. It's actually people wanting to love people and help people and do it at not a cost. You know, it's not about the Sunday morning, but it's about every day of the week. And every time we used to do something as a charity, people saw that there was something real about this Christian life. And in the space of, I was one Christian at that club, and we started to pray for the industry. With the chaplain, we started to pray for the industry of football. And within 3 years of praying that first prayer, we saw 8 Christian footballers at Portsmouth Football Club. We saw staff members being saved. We saw security guys coming in and wanting to be part of what we were doing at the club. We started to run alpha courses from the club. We saw hundreds and hundreds of people who wouldn't necessarily come into a church to experience what church life was, but they come to the football club, and we used to say to them, you know what, this is church as well. This is church. Because we had to meet them where they were, and they had to see that it was real. And in that period of time, I've seen God do so many things, so many amazing things. After 8 years of playing at Pompey, had a couple of operations. I know I held the FA Cup in that last scene, but I didn't actually play. I was part of that squad. And everyone said to me, Lynn, didn't you, you know, you must have been upset you didn't get to play. And I said, I was for a moment, but I didn't hear it. But I got the loudest cheer when I held that cup, because every fan of Pompey knew for year upon year, everybody wrote me off. The newspapers, the match of the day, all those guys wrote me off. And I said, you know what, I don't care about them because I'm doing this for God. I don't care what they've got, you know, what man's going to say. This is for God. And he allowed me to play and do some of the best things I could have never ever dreamed of. Retired, had to retire through knee injury. And that wasn't a hard decision to make, because in my heart, something had changed to football. Something had really changed. So when I retired, I felt a real peace about it, because I knew God had a plan for me after football had finished. I became ambassador for 2 years, and then I got made redundant. And that redundancy, that moment, took 5 minutes. 12 years of service to a football club was over in 5 minutes. When I came out of that room, they gave me a letter to fill it, a form to fill in, and I thought, What's this? I don't even know. I've never filled in a form like this before. But I was happy. I was relieved. The only reason I was relieved, because I knew in my heart God was moving me into something else. And as good as my football life was, as good as the Premier League was, I knew what I was moving into would be much, much exciting. I don't know, because sometimes I don't think it's exciting because of the stuff we go through, but it was somewhere where God was moving me that I knew where I had to be. And the only way I can describe it, I use a little phrase, that the best is still to come. The best is still to come, because I'm doing it for God. I'm doing it for Jesus and that life change in me. I'm just going to finish and just say that even though I'm up here speaking and, you know, and I've done this a few times, if I had the option, if it was my option, I wouldn't do it, because I'm the person that likes to be in the back supporting others and letting others get on with it. But because of what Jesus has done in my life, there's no way I can be quiet about it. There's not a chance. And I will travel the world to tell one person, to tell one. I will do that. Because what has happened in my life, my wife's life, my kids' life, you know, more importantly for me, my mum and dad, because they used to go to church every Sunday, but they didn't have a relationship with Jesus. And after 3 years, I spoke to them about this relationship. It didn't go down too well. It was a tough conversation. It didn't go down well. But a year later, at different times, got a phone call from mum saying, you know, I've accepted Jesus as my saviour, I get it. Then a couple of months afterwards, my dad independently said, I've received Jesus as my saviour. I cried. I honestly cried. And for me, I've seen so many of my friends saved and through different things and having a relationship now with Jesus, which has been amazing. And I'm just going to finish by saying that I made 3 big decisions in my life, and the first, obviously, accepting Jesus as my saviour, best decision I've ever made, getting married to Trish, and us having a journey together all the way through the ups and downs. I'll quickly just say, the depression didn't stay away, it came back, it tried to come back, It tried to come back a few times, but we had to stand on the word. We had to stand on the promises of God. We had to keep repeating them daily, daily. That was her new tablet, reading the word and applying the word, and the depression's gone. It has gone. It has gone. And the third one, we haven't got it on the DVD, but it's a tackle against Wayne Rooney. It was in the dying minutes of the game. It was in the penalty box. I had the decision to make. I could either foul him outside the box and get sent off, or try and tackle him inside the box and get it right. And fortunately enough, through God, I made the tackle, didn't get a penalty against me, and we won the game. So, hey, sorry, Man United fans. Sorry, Man United fans. But I think that was a good decision. But in all seriousness, you know, it's been an amazing journey. And like I say, the best is still to come. It really is. So thank you very much for listening. And got some questions as well.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so you're ready for some questions?
I'm ready.
Okay.
Uh-oh.
I'll start off with an easy one.
Thank you.
A number of people have actually texted in asking who the best player you ever played against was.
Thierry Henry, by far the best. The only reason was you knew, obviously, Sky covering match of the day, so you knew exactly what he was going to do. He used to go out wide, you used to get yourself ready, you used to think, I've got him, oh no, he's gone, he scored. You know, it's like, okay, week in, week out, he used to do it, and he'd done it to me a few times, so yeah, most difficult, definitely.
Okay. Similar kind of question, best player you ever played with?
I know, that's so tough. You know, I said Harry doesn't like to be called a wheeler and dealer, but on transfer deadline, last second, before midnight, he'd sign an unbelievable player, so there were so many, but Robert Prosinecki, who played for Real Madrid and Barcelona, latter stages of his career, but he still had the magic. Mm-hmm. The only difference was he smoked at half time, which we weren't quite used to. You know, used to walk into the dressing room and you go. Paul Merson, another player who came in later stages, didn't really have to perform if he didn't want to, but chose to. And he was a major reason why we got promoted to the Premier League, because his passes and gameplay was immense, really was immense.
Okay. You mentioned about Harry Redknapp, and obviously the first impressions weren't great from his side. But after that kind of initial sort of setback, how did you actually get on with Harry in day-to-day football?
Yeah, really good. You know what, we had a mutual respect, because I was the only player, he said there's only been a couple of players that have changed his mind, and I was one of those guys. You know, he honestly said, I didn't think Linvoy had a future here, but time and time again, he's proved himself. And because of that, he knew he could rely on me. I'd give my best. And I always said, no matter how I perform, as long as I give my best, and if that's not good enough, then give me a chance for it not to be good enough. And Harry respected that. And now, you know, I hadn't spoken to him for a few years after he left Portsmouth for the second time. Hadn't spoken to him for a while, and I was having a testimonial game, and he rang me up, and he said, "Linvoy, just wish you all the best. You really deserve it. You know, you've overcome a lot." And I was, inside, I thought, "Oh, that's nice." He didn't have to do that. So we've got a good, a good mutual, healthy friendship in that sense. And the same with Alan Kerbishley as well. You know, because at the time you think it's personal, but it's not. They're making decisions on what they see in the future, And they didn't see me as the future, but, you know, it was something at the time that helped me get through.
Okay. We actually got this question from the youth minister. He was wondering if you ever got a brown paper envelope from Harry.
Off the record, Rosie gave me a brown... Rosie, his dog. But, No brown paper envelopes, no.
He did offer a serious question as well. He asked... practically, what did you do to display yourself as a Christian in the dressing room on the pitch?
You know what? I never went in and preached, because there were lots of different things going on in the dressing room, lots and lots of different things. And if I was ever asked a question, then I'd give an answer, but I'd never give my opinion, even if it was right in front of me and conversation was going on. If I wasn't involved, I never got in the way. But what I tended to do, when there were issues that were involving me and decisions that had to be made, then I would come with a voice of reason. But I think the biggest point, the way they saw me, lots of the lads saw me, was when there was a problem in terms of me not playing and stuff, they saw me act and react the same way, with calmness, getting out there, training hard. And even inside, when I didn't want to do it, I thought, this is for God. And that's what spoke to them more. What I actually done on the training pitch and around, and the charity as well, spoke to them a lot more. And that's when, after a year or so, they started to ask me to pray for certain things in their lives. And we had a couple of big things happen. One player died in a car crash. We had 9/11 at the same sort of time. And the lads were saying, well, what's going on here, Lynn? You know, where's God in this? And I said, I don't know. And because I said, I don't know, they accepted that. I didn't try and explain it because I couldn't. And I think there was a little bit of respect for not trying to give answers that I didn't know the answers to.
Very good. Before I ask Linvoy the last question, does anyone in the audience have any questions for Linvoy that they didn't maybe text through?
Yeah, I'd like to ask Linvoy, you mentioned Alpha.
Yep.
We in the church here do Alpha twice a year. Mm. One in the local hotel down here in the Torres Corner.
Yep.
And one in the Black Box in Belfast.
Right. Okay, well, Alpha Course is an eight to 10 week course exploring the Christian faith, and it's an opportunity to ask any question you want. And I joined an Alpha Course with Trish, with some guys from church, and again, this was tough for us because we were going into an environment where we had to meet new people. And I've got to say, we've made good friendships there that have carried on. That have carried on to now, and this was over 10 years ago. And some of the questions that were asked at Alpha, I used to think, oh no, how are they going to answer that? You know, but when I heard the answer, I thought, oh. And sometimes I didn't agree with the answers, but the answers weren't coming out of thin air, they were coming out of the Bible. And if anybody's really thinking about or have heard about Alpha and not too sure if it's for them, I'd say give it a go. And over the course of 10 to 12 years now, I've been involved in Alpha courses in different forms and different ways, and every time there's the same questions come up, that where can you ask these questions? Can you ask them in the workplace? Could you ask them in the dressing room? No, but there's an environment where you can ask them those questions, and those questions are real life questions. You know, what is going on in this world today? You can ask those questions because the answers are there. So if you are thinking, if you hear about the Alpha course and you see it, you are thinking about it, you know, even if you give it a couple of weeks just to see, and it's not your thing, then that's fine, but give it a go. It'll really, really open your eyes. It really will.
Anyone else? Yep.
Will I ever go into management? No way. No way. I like my locks this colour. When you become a manager, overnight you go grey. You know? No, I really believe you've got to be passionate about what you do, and I enjoy seeing people change from all ages, and I prefer to work with the people or the young players who have been told that they can leave clubs, because I know that there's still a career for them, whether it's football, whether it's another career path completely. I know there's still life after football, and to be able to speak into people's lives, young men especially, who think it's over, to be able to tell them that there's more to life and then just football, then that's great. So I prefer that side of it. It's a no management for me. And then next week I'll have a scarf over my head. Next Portsmouth manager, Linvoy Primus. But he told us he weren't going to be manager. No, there's no way. No way. Not. I don't think there's a way. But you never know.
Okay. And what was your question you still want to ask?
Lionel Messi was too scared to play against me. He didn't turn up. I invited him. No, I played against Beckham, and he was very, very good. He was that good. He scored a goal, and when it went in the net, you're not supposed to do this, so please don't do this if it happens, but he scored a goal that was so good that I looked at our goalkeeper, who was Shaka Hislop, and I started laughing because it went in a place where no one else could put it, and literally I went, and we got beat 3-1. So, but yeah, Beckham, it was good to play against him, and Messi, no, not yet. I'm waiting for him. I might play him in cage football. It'll be too quick for me, I think.
Okay. Just a final question. It's quite a serious question, actually. Yeah. Through the course of your career, you've had various kind of disappointments. I'm just thinking back to, you know, those guys at 16, still happens every year, get released and don't go on to become professional footballers. Mm. What would you say to those people, you know, maybe there's some sitting in here today that just really feel that disappointment and aren't really sure where their life is going or what's going to be next for them? What encouragement would you give them?
I'd say sometimes the way we'd like our lives to go and play out, it doesn't quite go like that. And never to give up hope, because I like I said at the very start, that I, for most of my life, I was only on half power, you know, and I used to get up, when I was knocked down, I used to get up and fight and go again. But in the end, you lose a lot of energy and you lose a lot of the will to carry on. But the moment I said 11 years ago, the moment my life changed was 11 years ago, and I was running on full power, but I still didn't understand how much power and potential was in me. And we've all got the potential to become and do so much, we really have. But it's plugging in and listening to the right people at the right time. And I say, even if there are disappointments and life doesn't look the best, there is still a hope. There's a real hope, a real hope. And I have found that, my family have found that through Jesus. And there's an opportunity to see who this Jesus is. That's where I found that real hope. And like I said, if the kids weren't in here, I would say, well, I searched for that hope. And I didn't get the answers there. And it wasn't until I found Jesus that hope was there. So wherever you are at this moment in time, don't think it's over. You know, do not dare believe it's over, because there is something better for you to move into. So that's what I'd say.
Can we give a final round of applause to Lindboy? Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.